Podcast. I am your host, Kate, and each week we will be taking a deep dive into a random topic that has sparked my interest. This week's topic comes from a friend of mine who had asked me about the history of hamburgers and also why they seem to be so addicting. And I thought this would be interesting because I myself have recently gone through a health journey. I think we can all probably say that we have been on some sort of health journey at some point in our lives. At least everybody that I know has tried various diets and lifestyle changes and that sort of thing. I thought that this topic would be something that might touch on some interesting points as we deep dive into hamburgers and fast food in general. Before we get started, I hope that you're all having a wonderful Friday and are looking forward to the weekend ahead. One of the first things that I want to say about this topic is that I encourage you to remove the words good and bad from your vocabulary when you're talking about food. Food has no morality. It is morally neutral, so it is neither good nor bad. It just is. And it might be helpful to consider using words like more or less nutritionally dense, or think about foods based on their macronutrients that they provide. So for those of you that don't know, well, first, let me say that I am not a nutritionist. I've just done a ton of research into different topics surrounding food. One of the reasons being that I am a gym bro and am always interested in learning new information about how nutrition can help me with my goals in the gym as far as strength training goes. And so one of the things that I've really looked into as far as that goes is micro and macronutrients. Macronutrients are the protein, fat, and carbohydrate content of a particular food. And then the micronutrients are like the smaller, you know, vitamins and minerals, that kind of thing. So it can be helpful to think about food in terms of its macronutrients. So for example, let's say meat is your protein source. So some meat like white fish or chicken are high in protein and low in fat, and obviously low in carbohydrates. So you would consider that a protein source. Some meats like burgers or chicken nuggets, for example, are high in protein, yes, because they have the meat component, but they are also high in fat and carbohydrates as well. It's not considered a lean meat or a lean protein. You have to think of it as what all it's contributing to your diet. This doesn't mean that one is good and one is bad. It just means that one group might be more aligned with your nutrition goals compared to the other group. Also, we don't live in a vacuum. I think it is unrealistic to say, unless you have something like an allergy or an underlying health condition, I do not think that it is realistic to say, I'm never going to eat XYZ again. Because when you restrict yourself from something mentally, it almost is like it makes you want it more, right? I think that if you are trying to make dietary changes, you really, instead of thinking like, I'm never gonna eat this again, unless it's something that you like legitimately have to cut out because of health reasons or things like that, I think it may be helpful to say, I am going to maybe reduce my intake of it, or it'll just be on these certain, like the weekends, for example, that I will have my chocolate or whatever the case may be. And that doesn't mean, again, that the chocolate is bad. It just means that it's not aligning with my goals. And so I want to reduce it. So another example of looking at the macronutrients of what you're eating, consider a plate of broccoli. It is high in carbohydrates and it is low in fat, assuming that it has not been smothered in butter. And then think about a plate of French fries. These are also high in carbs, but they're also high in fat. The fiber in the broccoli helps reduce the glucose that's absorbed, but While the fries also have fiber because they are from potatoes, the high fat content and low satiety that they produce may not make them the better choice. Satiety is the feeling of fullness. That is why foods that are typically more calorically dense, like chocolate, potato chips, French fries, they have low satiety but high calorie density. That basically means that you have to eat a ton of it in order to even start to feel a little bit full because of the low satiety. You're not satiated, you don't feel full. Whereas like a plate of broccoli or a plate of carrots or whatever the vegetable maybe, they have high satiety, so they make you feel full more quickly, and so you tend to not overeat them because of that. We'll get into a more detailed look at fast food in general, but first, let's answer the question of where did hamburgers even come from? Taking this way, way back. Around 10,000 years ago, cattle was first domesticated in Mesopotamia. Now, the reason why I bring up cattle being domesticated is that the article that I was reading basically said that once cattle became domesticated, it set the stage for beef as a staple in humans' diets. And so that's kind of where that comes from. Then in the 12th century in Hamburg, Germany, it was growing as an independent trading city specializing in beef delicacies. Jumping up to 1848, political revolutions spurred an increase in German immigration to the U.S., and with the German people came the German food. Because Hamburg was known as an exporter of high-quality beef, restaurants began offering Hamburg-style chopped steak. Then in 1867, a New York doctor named James Salisbury suggested that cooked beef patties might be healthy for digestion, giving birth to the Salisbury steak. Now, this is sort of a random tangent because when I was looking this up, the article that I was reading stated that this Dr. James, his suggestion of cooking the beef was sort of a novel thing at this time because apparently doctors back in the day would prescribe raw beef as a digestive aid for people, which is kind of insane. And so then I kind of went off on a tangent looking that up, and I found this story about this guy who, through a series of unfortunate events, ends up getting shot in the abdomen, and they think he's gonna die, and then he ends up surviving with like a hole leading into his stomach that just never closes. And so this doctor guy, who was his friend who kind of helped him recover, basically, for the remainder of this dude's life, he was doing experiments on him and this little hole leading to his stomach to kind of figure out how digestion even worked, because doctors at this time didn't even really know how it worked. For example, in the article, it said that they didn't understand what gastric juice was. They thought that it was impossible for it to be acidic because I think at that time, a researcher had looked into the stomach contents of animals and had found that hydrochloric acid was in that. And doctors didn't believe that it would be in human stomachs because they didn't think that we could survive that being in our, that strong of an acid being inside of us. So this doctor, much to the poor luck of this patient, was able to really do a lot of studies into how digestion works because of this hole in this guy's stomach. So anyway, random tangent about the guy with the hole in his stomach. Jumping from the Salisbury steak as the way that people were consuming ground beef to between bread, like how we know it today, occurred in the later part of the 19th century, but no one knows where the first hamburger actually was. The first widespread audience for the hamburger was at the 1904 St. Louis World's Fair, where it was one of the foods that was presented at that time. Then, 2 years later, Upton Sinclair released The Jungle, which detailed the unsavory side of the American meatpacking industry. Industrial ground beef at this time was easy to mix with fillers, preservatives, and meat scraps, making the hamburger a prime suspect as a culprit in this kind of gross processing. Then in 1921, the first White Castle opened in Kansas, countering the bad reputation of hamburger meat by boasting cleanliness and a commitment to good health with an on-site meat grinder, so customers knew their product was fresh and unaltered. This became the inspiration for other chains, with McDonald's and In-N-Out established in 1948, Burger King coming in 1954, followed by Wendy's in 1969. U.S. hamburger culture has spread globally, in part due to the military bringing it with them. And today, nearly 50 billion hamburgers are served annually in the U.S. alone. So, why is the hamburger and fast food so popular? Well, in 2018, the National Center for Health Statistics reported that 36.6% of adults in the U.S. consumed fast food in any given day. The issues of eating fast food, like obesity, heart disease, diabetes, and some cancers, are well known. So I wanted to look into why people still stop by fast food restaurants, because we know that it's not good for us, right? Especially maybe not so much on like a one-off instance or, you know, every once in a while, but definitely not every day and definitely not more often than not, you know? So why are these fast food chains so popular? Well, the first thing is pretty obvious. It's convenience factor, right? Fast food is quick, relatively cheap, and made by somebody else who wants to work for 8 hours and then come home and cook and then clean up after you've cooked. That's a big part of why it's so popular, and I get that because I am definitely one who will pay for convenience if the opportunity is granted to me, to be honest. The other part of this is that they are manufactured to cause cravings. Fast food companies are not stupid, and they know what they're doing to get you to want to eat the food. The first sort of part of this is that they have high palatability, which means that they're tasty. So foods that are high in sugar and fat, and subsequently high in calories, will tap into the pleasure centers of our brains. So basically, you eat these tasty foods, and then your brain releases dopamine because it's responding to the sugar and fat. And then this feel-good neurotransmitter reinforces that loop of wanting to eat it again and again, right? Because if you look at it from an evolutionary perspective, we are wired this way because back in, you know, our hunter-gatherer times, eating foods that were high in calories were better for our survival. And at that time, we're talking about hunter-gatherer foods. So fruits, berries, nuts, obviously the meat that you could kill and catch are going to be what's on the menu. It's not Taco Bell drive-thru. And so our brains are very much still stuck in this primitive sort of way of addressing what we're eating. So this part of our brain is hardwired, like I said, because it's that survival mechanism, and it's very hard to get out of that. And it has served humanity well for thousands of years to be this way. And so it's not like it's just going to disappear from our genetic makeup overnight. In fact, I don't know that it will ever disappear, because at the end of the day, your body's sole purpose is to stay alive. This kind of feedback loop makes sense in regard to wanting to stay alive. The other sort of brain component, or another sort of brain component for this, is that eating junk food due to stress or anxiety will tap into the habit circuit that's in your brain. So then you have this other layer of, now you're forming a habit. Like, I don't feel well. I'm sad. I'm anxious. I'm stressed, whatever the case may be. So I'm going to eat. And then it makes me feel better, right? Because you're not, at least I'm not, when I'm sad, grabbing a carrot to munch on, right? I'm grabbing the chocolate, I'm grabbing chips, whatever the case may be, which again are those foods that are high in sugar and fat. And so it's now creating that feedback loop in your brain, like, yes, please continue to consume this food. And then because that's what you do habitually, now you're tapping into that habit forming center of your brain where it's just what you're going to reach for without even really thinking. The other part of this is that carbs can increase your serotonin production, which creates a temporary mood boost, but that mood boost is followed by a letdown, which will bring you your mood down, possibly back into that depression or anxiety state, which then triggers you to eat that junk food again. So it's kind of like this hamster wheel that you get stuck on. So when your brain starts to crave that dopamine hit, it will actually cause your stomach to produce a hormone that triggers feeling hungry. And then eating the junk food releases the dopamine that you were craving, which then creates that positive reinforcement loop again. Ultra-processed foods can also interfere with the signaling of leptin, which is the hormone that tells our body to stop eating. So people who consume these foods all the time can actually develop leptin resistance, where the hormone stops working, which can lead to overeating. So not only are you, again, feeding into that dopamine hit, habit-forming loop in your brain, but now you're also potentially creating some leptin resistance, which is what tells you to stop eating. And so now if that's resistant, then you don't have that trigger to tell you to stop eating. And so it's just kind of like a vicious cycle, honestly. Now, fast food and junk food companies invest a ton of money into research and development to make their foods hyperpalatable using artificial flavors, food colorings, dyes, and preservatives to enhance their food's taste and appearance. They engineer food to inspire cravings by focusing on things like the smell, the crunch factor, texture, taste, colorful look, and appeal. So, what can we do about this? Well, I think the first thing to remember is that fast food chains are not in the business of looking out for your health. So, stop expecting them to do better, because they're not. At the end of the day, they are all about making money. And the way they make money is to get you to crave their food or want to buy their food. And so, they're going to do it in the way that works the best. Instead, if you want to make a change, focus on small steps that work for you and your lifestyle. So maybe instead of buying fruit juice that's loaded with added sugar, you could consider eating the actual fruit. In the article that I was reading, it gave the example of eating an orange versus drinking orange juice. Now, I understand, like, in the morning, you may just want like a glass of orange juice, and I get that. But for the purposes of this example, the point is that the juice has a lot of added sugar, and the actual fruit, while it does have its own sugar, it also comes with fiber, and the fiber is actually what slows down the process of absorbing that sugar into the bloodstream. So that's why when they talk about net carbs of a food, you subtract the fiber from the sugar amount to get your net carb amount, because the fiber, it's not that it cancels the sugar out, but it's the way that it's all absorbed in your digestive tract. So the fiber actually blocks some of that sugar from getting absorbed, or that glucose from getting absorbed into the bloodstream. The other thing that this article asked, which I feel like is a little patronizing, but I'm going to tell you what it said anyway. They said, ask yourself if you're just thirsty or bored. The hunger and thirst centers can get confused in the brain, and mindless snacking is definitely inspired by boredom. Their suggestion was to drink a glass of water if you think you're hungry or if you're craving junk food. And yeah, that could work maybe, but I really think, I don't think that that's a realistic thing to ask people to do, truthfully. I think that for me anyway, I have a really terrible sweet tooth. And so for me, first of all, I drastically reduced the amount of sugar in my diet in general. So sugar is hidden in a lot of things that you wouldn't think about. So consider reading like the labels of the food that you're buying for the sugar content, because stuff like peanut butter, salad dressings, condiments, what else? Tomato sauce, stuff like that has a crap load of added sugar. And so for me, somebody who has a sweet tooth, really drastically dropping the amount of added sugar in my normal day-to-day eating has helped me with my cravings of sweets. So yes, I still have a sweet tooth, but it's not like this gnawing craving for sugar, because I'm not feeding it in ways that you wouldn't normally think of feeding it. Cutting it out of my actual meals or reducing the sugar in my actual meals has helped me to not want to have chocolate for dessert, for example. So that could be something that could be helpful. And then consider meal prepping so that convenience isn't an issue when it comes to making food choices when you're already tired and hungry. I know, again, for me, being able to conveniently reach for food that's already in my fridge is much more likely to happen after I've been working all day. And so what I like to do is I'll prep a big container of like a protein source for the week, a container of two different kinds of vegetables for the week, and then I can just reheat them and eat them as I want. So that way I'm not really having to do much work at the end of the day to feed myself, but then I can also have some control over what I'm actually ingesting so that I can stay on track with the goals that I have for myself. So I know that was kind of a lot, but in conclusion, fast food isn't the devil, but it's clear that it's not really part of a balanced diet either. And fast food or convenience food companies truly don't give two shits about potential future health consequences when all they're chasing is money. The best advice I ever received is that if you want to make a lasting change, you cannot simply go on a diet. You really have to make it a lifestyle change. Let go of the food morality. It's not serving any purpose but to make you feel bad, and instead focus on making choices that fuel your goals. Do you want to live longer and healthier? Do you want to build muscle? Do you want to reach and maintain aesthetic goals? Because aesthetic goals are just as valid as strength goals or longevity goals, in my opinion. Taking small, easily attainable steps towards your goals can have a real snowball effect, and the next thing you know, you'll be reaching that version of yourself that you want. Don't be too hard on yourself, and remember, it's all about finding a balance that works for you. I hope that you all have a wonderful rest of your day, and I will see you next Friday.